Welcome, everyone. This is Jazz on the Tube, and I'm Ken McCarthy. And today we're going to be talking with Milcho Leviev. And he is a fascinating person with a fascinating history, and as you're going to find out very soon. So without further ado, Milcho, welcome.
Thank you.
And we're going to start by talking about something that fascinates me as an American jazz fan. Sometimes jazz is popular, sometimes jazz is not popular, but no one has ever prohibited jazz, as far as I know. But that's not true for Eastern Europe. The place where I'd like to talk about, what I'd like to start is, Milcho, what was your life like as somebody interested in jazz in Bulgaria?
Okay, let me start with the fact that I was born in 37. So when the war, the Second World War, ended, was 45. So I was 7 years old, and I could reason, right? So the Soviet Army, which was the, you know, with the Americans and the English, the Western things came from the West and the East, they occupied my country, Bulgaria, which was a kingdom at that time. The king died before that. He didn't want the Bulgaria to be involved in the war, but maybe that's why he was killed. So anyhow, Bulgaria was under the fascist regime, the Nazis, and after the communists took over a little bit later, 46, they said that the Soviet army liberated Bulgaria from, actually, the Soviet army occupied the country and establish a dictatorship of the type of any dictatorship in contemporary things, like Hitler. And talking about jazz, and the communists never officially banned jazz, but they were afraid of jazz more than the rock and roll. You know, they would rather play Elvis Presley and stuff, because not that there's no good stuff in the rock and roll. Like Duke Ellington said, there are two kinds of music, good music and the other kind, and the other kind. So I don't mind, but they were not afraid of this because they were psychologists. They understood that life teaches people, inspires them to be free, you know what I mean? So they rightfully, like Hitler, based it on a racial thing. That is the Negro music, that's a low race music, and blah, blah, blah. But, of course, in the communist regime, nobody could say things like racial things. You know, communism is, you know, equality of everybody and stuff like that, blah, blah, blah. So they started saying that actually, when I was trying to argue with them later, I'm speaking with that, this is actually the music of the poor people. They came from Africa, they were slaves. They were blah blah. They were actually the working class. There's nothing decadent, nothing bourgeois, nothing capitalistic in this thing. Oh, they say no. That was before. Now rich men are freer. They are rich, and most of them are with the capitalism. They serve the capitalism. Absolute ideological bullshit. You know what I mean? So nobody could convince them. So jazz was underground. But let me continue with me how I started the jazz. So the war ended in Glenn Miller Orchestra was very popular. And before the communists took over, which was the Bolshevik, actually, a year later, we were able, I was 8 years old, but I saw Rhapsody in Blue, Gershwin, I saw American films, and on the radio they didn't play the real jazz, but let's say pop jazz, like Glenn Miller in the Root. And I remember I had a very good ear. I took it off from the radio. I was playing, you know, doo-doo-doo-doo-doo, stuff like that. And then I started teach the lessons, and I always had a problem with don't play that music and blah, 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 blah. But nobody could stop me. I didn't know that, for example, In the Mood actually is 12-bar blues, you know. And later, when I went to the Bulgarian Music Academy to study, a guy that was actually a violinist, but he was into jazz, he was listening to Voice of America, he was taking off the radio some stuff. And when I played for him In the Mood, he said, look, first, this is not real jazz. It's not pop music. Glenn Miller is great, but you know. But do you know what are you playing now? I said, in the mood. Yeah, now it's in the mood. But what form is this? I said, I don't know. He said, this is blues. I said, wait a minute. Blues is, I think, slow dance. No. Blues could be fast. Could be, you know. He told me that's the black people thing with the spiritual. He knew. He already spoke English and everything. So I learned jazz. We were at that time when the war ended. It's not, but from 1960, when I graduated from the Academy of Music, there was a so-called in the Eastern Europe dictatorship melting when Khrushchev came in power. So jazz was neither allowed nor forbidden, but was better off without it. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So I found a group called Focus 65 in 1965, and we were extremely successful in the West. We went to Montreal first jazz festival, 1967, in which festival there was some kind of a competition because every country sent the radio and the big band in Europe. That's only European. The Montreal was a small festival. And was a competition, and my group, which was Quartet, Focus 65, won the Critics' Prize, which was a big thing. Mm. But look, now that's the interesting stuff. After that, we gave hundreds of concerts in Western Europe. But in Bulgaria, my home country, we gave only 3 concerts. Huh. Why? Why? Because the whole policy was, look, we don't forbid jazz in Bulgaria. Look, this Focus 65, great reviews, NPS recorded us. All those things you can find on the tube, actually, not the story, but the music that I recorded with this group and everything. So, to make the long story short, I got tired of all this bullshit. You know what I mean? And even they put us on little salaries just because in Bulgaria there is no... This is jazz, but not jazz. We opened a jazz club, but I opened it with an old Bulgarian patriotic song, which they make into a New Orleans Dixie kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
And they summoned me to the Communist Party headquarters, and they said, Comrade, Mr. Comrade Leviev, what did you play on the opening of that little jazz club? I said, so and so and so. But how did you play it? I played like the suggestion. So you were mocking our patriotic songs, and they closed the jazz club. They closed the jazz club.
Whoa.
You know what I mean? These stories, they're witnesses. And I've told the stories. There is a book about me in Bulgarian, not translated yet, and the stories are there. But it's interesting to tell them in English. I've told a lot of these stories in America, some people don't believe me. I'll tell you just one story which blow your mind.
Okay.
When the Bossa Nova came, right, about the 60s, right, in the 50s, early Bulgaria, we started playing Bossa Nova. I was the conductor of the National Radio Big Band, which was called not Big Band and not Jazz Band, but Variety Orchestra. Variety.
Uh-huh.
That means we play 1% jazz and 80% Soviet pseudo jazz and something like that. Even that in Soviet Union, they had great jazz underground. But anyhow, when the boss came, I was the conductor of the big bands, and they summoned me again in the radio, national radio, in the Communist Party Bureau. And they said again, Drugario means comrade. Comrade Leviev, put an end. Thought I'm playing Bossa Nova. I said, why? Well, they said, do you know who imported Bossa Nova in North America? I said, I do. The American jazz musicians. I said, like Stan Getz, like Charlie Burt. Okay, good. You know that. But he said, do you know who sent these guys, these people, to Brazil in order to get the Bossa Nova? I said, who? I don't know, they're agents. Comrade Leviev, that's what you don't know. CIA sent Getz, and I said, Wait, why? Check this now. I'll say it slowly. In order to boycott the cha-cha-cha from our brother communist country, Cuba. I said, wait. I said, cha-cha-cha is a pop dance. Bossa Nova is not a dance. Bossa Nova is the Brazilian way of playing jazz. Exactly, that's what we're... That's American music. I said, this is South American music with jazz elements. Cavadelia, no more arguments, no bossa nova. So after all these things, I left the conductor's position, which people said, are you crazy, man? It's, you know, it's famous and shit, and you know what I mean. So the one thing after the other came to the point that I had to split from the country. I was married but divorced. I had a little child, and it was extremely, extremely emotionally and anyway to leave the country. I didn't have any idea what I'll do. I had a friend in Germany. I defected to Germany. And then I remember that I knew Daniel Ellison. We exchanged some charts. And Daniel decided to be my sponsor too, because I am persona non grata, no passport, no citizenship, right? Everything is, I'm an escapee. So he sponsored to me, they gave me green card, and I went to America, and the rest was the history. So that's a little bit long, but that's the story.
Wow.
That's the first question.
Such a strange political environment with...
Yeah, let me ask you a question. Have you interviewed some other guy from the communist like Paquito de Rivera or Valerie Palmiro, the trumpet player that played with Arbecki, or, you know, like Jan Hammer? There are a lot of guys, Miroslav Vitos, who played with Weather Report, George Mraz, the bass player. Oh, by the way, if you're interested, there is a video clip, I'll send it to you. 10 years ago, there was a big tribute to Willis Canover. Now, people in America don't know what Willis Canover is, but this is the DJ that from the Voice of America was broadcasting jazz.
Ah,
you know?
Okay.
And that's how we learn. So in Washington D.C. 10 years ago, we got a little band: Paquito de Rivera on saxophone, Valerie Paponimorev on trumpet. I was on piano. George Mraz, or Izzy Mraz in Czechoslovakia, but in English, he's George Mraz. You probably heard his name. He's a very well-known bass player. So he played with Ted Jones, Mel Lewis, all those people. So, and there was a drummer from Cuba. And there's a clip, 5 minutes, I could send it to you, because I discovered it not long ago on YouTube. So I didn't know. It was not under my name. It was under Paquito de Rivera name, because he gathered the band, this little combo, and it was a great thing, because you know what? For the Eastern Europe, this man, Willis Canover, was the savior. Because we were taping his show, and he had not prejudiced to any kind of jazz. He played for New Orleans, to Cecil Taylor, you know what I mean?
Yeah, that's
so
great.
We were the whole jazz, real jazz, listen, we were not more than two of each instrument, you know, like about 20 guys. And we were exchanging the recordings. It was impossible to get an LP and anything like that, because the borders, you know, they check everything for magazines, for American music and blah, blah. But this radio, Voice of America, they were broadcasting from Munich, Europe. Willis Canover was recording in Washington, D.C., Voice of America, Jazz Hour. And they were broadcasting, but the communist countries invented a thing to obstruct this thing with machines on the borders that were jamming the stations, you know what I mean, the Western stations. So we all are recording with our primitive tape recorders, and whoever got a little bit better thing without the feedback or the machines, we were very, very, very like hard to take off these melodies and jazz and how to learn it. So as a teacher now, I tell the guys today, hey, with this internet, we have old Charlie Parker's solo taken out on paper. we have to do these things by ourselves.
Right.
Right here.
Right. So, the system was the Voice of America would somehow get the signal in, and then everybody would run their tape recorders, and whoever got the best copy would share it with everyone else.
Yeah. And it was 1 o'clock in the morning.
I imagine people did this surreptitiously. They did it quietly. They didn't advertise what they
were
doing.
Absolutely. Listen, that was a clique of jazz musicians, and you don't talk loud about jazz and things. For example, in the radio big band, when they allowed some jazz, the percentage of the music was like this that we have to record and play on the radio. Mm-hmm. 50% Soviet popular music.
Uh-huh.
Popular music, you know. Soviet jazz, there was Soviet jazz, but no Soviet jazz, right? But the word jazz was avoided.
Mm-hmm.
Jazz was in the category pop music, right? Which is not true, but anyhow. Then there were 30% Bulgarian pop music. That makes 80, right?
Okay.
And then there was 15% of the pop music of the brother socialist countries like Yugoslavia, East Germany, Poland, Hungary, you know, those communist countries there were. And 5% for the Western music, of which 1% was American music, not jazz. So after I worked 5 years, so the whole year I recorded 3 pieces, one was the basis something, and we're taking all the arrangements from the radio, you know.
Yes.
Finally, the American embassy understood that I was interested in jazz, and they sent me a letter from the embassy. And this letter was, of course, captured by the secret police. They called me and they said, "Comrade Leviev, there is a letter from the American embassy." We opened it, of course, and it says that they want to give you some scores, some music sheet, music. We checked out. It's okay, but we want to warn you to be careful with this thing. I said, well, we'll be careful anyhow because the radio doesn't allow to record more than what it says, you know. So after I recorded this thing, I started doing things that are so funny, people in America didn't believe me. I recorded Soul Bossa Nova by Quincy Jones, which is a popish blues thing, and I renamed it in order to grow. I renamed it not Soul Bossa Nova, but something like Shtastia, which means happiness.
Okay.
By J. Quincy. And they asked me, who is this Quincy? I said, the very, very, very talented young Soviet pop composer. He's not known yet, but so I was lying, you know. And I have this proof, black and white, because it was issued a little 45, not LP, but you know, those the little 45 versions, little discs, you know.
Yeah.
And it's written on the label very clearly. J. Quincy, not Quincy Jones, but J. Quincy. And I never met Quincy to tell him that Bulgarians predicted that he will be married to Natasha Kinsky. So these type of things that are funny, people don't believe them. You know, they say, no, he invented the story. I'm 8 years old, man. I don't have any reason to lie or to invent things.
You know, I think anybody that's I have had the opportunity to visit Cuba a few times, and if anybody spends time in Cuba, this story will make a lot of sense. There's a lot of unusual controls that most of us would find baffling. Wow! So thank you for giving this that portrait. You are actually the first.
Excuse me that I interrupt you, but that's very interesting. Paquito de Rivera, who escaped from Cuba like me, he told me that his group Irakere, which was with Arturo Sandoval, with Chucho Valdez, great group, they got a Grammy, man.
Yep.
And Fidel Castro, the government, didn't allow them to go to to Los Angeles to get their Grammy.
Wow.
It's incredible shit. By the way, I recommend a book to everybody that's interested in Eastern European jazz and Cuban jazz. Paquito wrote a book entitled My Sax Life. My Sax Life. And he traveled in all the Eastern countries. I met him actually in Bulgaria with his group. But his group, when they were trying, they didn't play jazz. They played Soviet songs and things like that, you know.
Oh, really? When Paquito's group went to Bulgaria, they had to play Soviet music?
Not Soviet music, but they reduced their stuff to something from Cuban thing, mostly Cuban grooves that didn't have that much jazz. And we were jamming privately, and they discovered us, and we sat down, we played, we jammed real stuff, you know, not even Cuban, but straight ahead standards and things. You know, all these guys, man, like Paquito de Rivera, Chucho Valdez, the pianist, they are seasoned jazz and classical musicians, you know, because they studied in classical schools like I did, you know. So that's it. I mean, but this is the most interesting thing that we're talking now, because it's still not known very well in the West what really happened.
Yeah, the great challenges that the musicians in the East overcame, and they learned the music in spite. You know, now we have schools and conservatories and all kinds of places you can go and openly study jazz, but to have to teach yourself in secret, it's quite a thing. It's quite a thing.
Let me tell you, in connection to this, I wrote a piece for Symphony Orchestra and Jazz Trio. And they there was something in the L.A. at that time called the L.A. Jazz Philharmonic. Jack Elliott was the conductor. And there were jazz guys in the band with symphony guys. And when he opened the concert, he said, wow, what times were... I just remember when I was a kid in the music thing in Berkeley, whatever. Not Berkeley. Berkeley doesn't exist at that time, but in some classical thing. And old good grand pianos, they were rock, and there was a little sign: "Do not play jazz on this piano."
Wow!
This is in the United States of America, the country that jazz was. You know that in the history back first. They were trying again to be against the conservative people. First, what is this word, jazz? It's sexual, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So jazz had to fight for its existence in its own country, too.
Absolutely. I have a young nephew who's a very good flute player. He's 10. And his teacher, to this day, prohibits him from playing jazz. It's ridiculous. Yeah. Let's talk about the next phase of your life, which was when you landed in Los Angeles in, was it 1970?
No,
1971.
70, I defected to West Germany, and then when we got in contact with Don Ellis, he agreed to be my sponsor, because somebody has to sponsor, you know, as a refugee.
Yeah.
We have to have some people that will do some guarantee for you, you know. Anyhow, he was very fascinated. I joined his band immediately. I would never forget this. I flew to L.A. from Frankfurt, Germany. I landed in L.A., and his manager met at the airport. He said, "We're going to a rehearsal."
Wow.
I'm flying 15 hours, you know, or something. And I said, "Can I leave my suitcase?" "Oh, we'll go with the suitcase in the rehearsal. Then you'll go to Don's house. He will be his guest until we find some place," and blah, blah, blah. So that's how my life started, you know, with the rehearsal. And Don had the big tour, American tour at that time, and we recorded a great album in Basin Street West in San Francisco called Tears of Joy, which becomes more and more I saw on YouTube. I mean, 100,000s of people have heard it already for jazz.
And that was with Don Ellis?
With Don Ellis, yeah. His band, I was playing keyboards and arranging and my compositions. And Donald died very young because of the heart failure. He was only 44. But he's one of this sort of, not because I work with him, there's a lot of people who agree with me, sort of underrated, because his experiments with odd times, like in 5 and 7, first, there's nothing new. Brubeck did take 5 with all that. Desmond, this kind of meters, the argument was that they don't swing. The swing, in order jazz to swing, has to be 4-4. Mm-hmm. And Don Ellis' answer was, wait a minute, first, Fats Waller did the generic waltz
sure.
in 3-4 in time, right? Mm. Then, this, the argument was also, look, not only for jazz, this guy in 5 and 7, they're not natural. And Don Ellis said, why are not natural? Because you can't dance. Wait a minute, Don said. How come Indians, the whole East, Turkey, Bulgaria, how come these people dance in 9 and everything? So this is unnatural for them? You know what, Ken? You could make any music swing. Mm-hmm. Any music. The time when, Jerry Roll was asked, what is jazz? He said, everything is jazz, depending on how you do it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right?
And Ellis was a Los Angeles musician, born and raised, and that was his base.
No. He was not born. He was a back east guy. Look, he worked with the avant-garde people, with George Russell, with Charlie Mingus at that time. He played with Mingus. Then he decided to go to California, and first he was doing small groups. And later, in the late 60s, he decided to do not a big band, but orchestra. Mm-hmm. Later, in this orchestra, he put a string quartet, he put a tuba, he put a French horn. So it was for 22-piece orchestra. It was not a big band, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Big band, when you say it's not that it has to be straight ahead or anything, but still, big band is, you know, I mean, 4 trumpets, 4 trombones, 5 saxophones, you know, rhythm section. We had different things. I played electronics way ahead. Don was one of the first, actually. In late 60s, he started using the first electronics things. Then I joined Billy Cobham, and Billy Cobham was into the electronics. I was a little bit reserved for the electronics, not like you, Jerry.
Mm-hmm.
But I realized the electronics, like Joe Zanino told me, the electronics are okay depending on how you play on them. You know, you have to study them. You have to practice like you practice the piano. It's not a piano, right? When you play a D3 Hammond organ, you think they'll sit down and you play it, right?
You know who's a huge fan of Don Ellis is somebody that that we've had on to interview, Bobby Sanabria.
I've heard about him.
He's a great, great musician, a great educator, a great advocate, a great historian. He's based out of New York, but he's the one also who told me, Don Ellis, you got to listen to Don Ellis. And mm-hmm. I wasn't really aware of Ellis's music until Bobby suggested it. And yeah, very advanced stuff. And of course,
you know what? Let me make a little comparison. When
okay.
Sketches of Spain, which for me is a milestone in not jazz music, the music of the 20th century. When Gil Evans and Miles did this in 59,
mm-hmm.
I think they sold 1,000 copies or something. Now it's millions, and everybody knows Sketches of Spain.
Mm-hmm.
The greatest fusion of classical music, because all the melodies are from Spanish composers. That's why it's called Sketches of Spain, right?
Mm-hmm.
Concierto de Aranjuez, all these people that, you know. So I think with Don Ellis' music will happen the same thing. His popularity is growing slowly, but it's growing. Because, you know what, good critic said, the people are afraid of the unfamiliar.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's a racial thing also. When somebody is not like you, you're afraid. All of a sudden you hear music in these crazy rhythms. Oh, you know, you remember when Ornette Coleman appeared, or, even Cecil Taylor.
Yeah.
There's still people that deny him. They think he plays whatever he bangs at the piano. And I heard Cecil when he was young, he could play standards. Bullshit. You know.
Oh, yeah.
Of course. Of course.
It's the great challenge.
The yep. Yeah, yeah. And Don's music is very avant-garde. It sounds fresh even now. That's what the real music should be, always like this. Duke Ellington also sounds fresh. And, you know, even Duke, who was a successful commercial composer, even he had some problems, like, you know, with the music sometimes. Not to speak about the Beatles or Burt, or, you know, these people were without money, you know,
mm-hmm.
when they started this kind of service. So a lot of people against this music, you cannot dance on it, blah, blah, you know.
It's a great challenge for, you know, musicians. They are our pioneers of sound, and they have to blaze the trail. And sometimes you have to wait for the public to catch up.
It's always the case. Always yeah, the case.
Yeah. Hey, let's switch gears a little bit and talk about the great Art Pepper, who you performed with quite a bit. I'm really interested in your stories and impressions of him.
Yeah, the story is a big, you know, Lori Pepper, his widow, issued two books. One was called the biography that he told to Lori, his wife, and she put the book, like, anyhow, there are two books. But he was a very funny man, too. I mean, he was serious, but he was saying incredibly fun things. Funny, I'll tell you what, but let me tell you, the three people in the States that I learned music the most was Don Ellis, Billy Cobham.
Mm-hmm.
With Billy, I learned the electronics and the modern funk, kind of funk rock jazz thing. The fusion, you know, mm-hmm. like Willie Porter. And with Art Pepper, that was the school of jazz, really, because he, not only he grew up very big in the bebop era, but he changed his style of playing. He told me once he was studying Coltrane very much, but I said, Coltrane is a tenor. When? He said, I wanted to translate some of these things on alto to see how it would sound. Mm-hmm. And I've played clarinet incredibly, you know. But let me tell you the funny part, because when I teach jazz and things, I don't go to a lot of theory, I just tell them funny stories, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So listen to this story. We started touring with Arthur. We're going to Japan, right? So Japanese people speak English, but not that well. And Arthur's using slang. But so he's telling, when he announces the band, he says, you know, Tommy Dunn's on bass, and says a few words where he's from, then he goes, Carl Burnett on drums, he's from LA, blah, blah, blah. And he comes to me, the piano. Now, our piano is a special case, he said. He escaped from Bulgaria in order to play jazz. The Tsar of Bulgaria, the king, there's no king where the communist, told him, you cannot play jazz in my country, and he also escaped. Now, when he escaped, and listen now, he escaped through several rows of electrical wire. It's nothing like this. I've just traveled and I defected, but anyhow, under the wire with a knife in his mouth.
Mm.
That was the only weapon he had. And he was embellishing the story every night, and he reached to the point that I have killed some people on the way with a knife. And
wow.
Finally, his wife told him to stop. And people wouldn't understand, only the band was like, down the floor laughing, you know. The last thing he said was, not only I killed some adults, but I killed some babies. He was a crazy guy. Listen, he used to say incredible things, you know, like on the stage. So, of course, you say, what is this? You know, like his latest style, he was a smooth player when he started, like the type of Lee Konitz, like Paul Desmond.
Right.
This kind of a very gliding, beautiful tone of the saxophone.
Yep.
Almost nothing left in the old, after he changed, after Prison and everything, he started many people, some people think he's babbling, like, he's talking on this instrument. He's like talking, you know what I mean? That his style became, also he produces some very high tones that might be unpleasant, but he's screaming and singing, and he started using the bebop, because listen, without creativity, I mean, if you imitate some, if I sit down to note by note to imitate Whitney Carey or something, I mean, where's the point? I'll never be better than Whitney Carey. I could learn from him, mm-hmm. right? But I have to find my own way of playing, mm-hmm. right? So art, I think, is much more individual and unique in his latest part of his life, you know. And there were, the band was like this. Sometime with Josh Cable, sometime with me. Sometime Bob Magnuson was the bass player from L.A., and sometime Tony Dumas from L.A. But the drummer always was Burnett, Cal Burnett, absolutely underrated drummer. I mean, all the recordings, when you go to the YouTube, there are hundreds of recordings. And all of them, either the George Cal, I've been talking about the later era, not the, where he was in L.A. in the 50s, right? This after the 70s and stuff. There are so many, and they're incredible, you know, like, he's talking, he's like, he's not afraid to symbolically speak into Andres naked in front of the audience, mm-hmm. like the music he plays, you know. See, he was a great guy, and I love from him, not only the bebop roots and everything, and I learned quite a lot of things on the stage, and he was very, very, he was a funny guy, but he was very serious about the music. And it's yet to be appreciated his composing, because he never composed anything more than tunes for bowling, you know, not like symphony or anything like that.
Sure.
Even if he read music very well, but his music, the original compositions, had very unique individual thing that I haven't heard composing this type, you know. And that will be appreciated also a little bit later, because it's not so obvious, you know. When some obvious thing comes, like Ornette, or, you know, or the Fusion the first time, everybody notices this. But when you do it smoothly and noticeably, then it kind of avoids the, you know, people listen, but they don't hear.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep, I think that's a really, really good point about Art Pepper, and let's encourage everybody,
exactly.
If you don't really know Art Pepper's music, listen and really mm-hmm. listen and listen some more, and you'll discover a lot of things.
So was there any kind of music here, like in classical music, somebody says, oh, Fifth Symphony, Beethoven, I heard it, I know it.
Yeah.
Wait a minute, I said. Yeah. This symphony he wrote in this play maybe a million times. And the great conductors, great orchestra, always will play it some other way. Even that classical music is not like jazz and those, you know, improvisations, but I don't like the word performer. I like the word interpreter.
Mm-hmm.
Because even in classical music, without changing the text, the notes, you could interpret it a million different ways, with tempo, with feeling, with where to slow down, where to, you know what I mean? It's like... I always say, even classical music, the old classical music, you should play Tchaikovsky what it was written today. It should sound like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Otherwise, we could just have a computer play it and be done
Absolutely.
With it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about another phase. Finally, Bulgaria became a free country again, and you
yes.
returned. Can you talk a little bit about
yes.
that?
Sure, that was 1990 when the Berlin Wall went down, and I was invited. And this thing that's on YouTube, the first thing clip that they have about me is 1990. I went for New Year, they greeted me like a hero, blah blah blah. They exaggerated my value, because not the music so much, but that I showed the finger to the government before that, right? So I was met like hero anyhow. And I decided to play the tune by Jerry Lennon, Imagine.
Mm-hmm.
Because this tune, you know the text, it says, Imagine.
All the people
without, all the people without states, without religion, without
borders,
to be free and blah blah. So that was I played it, and it was very effective from solo piano. I made it, and I didn't play with the symphony because I was guest for the New Year's Eve concert in the biggest hall in Sofia, the capital. It's like 5,000 people hall, so. They invited me as an honorary guest, and they invited me to sit down at the piano to play something. And I said to myself, Imagine will be the greatest thing to play. Well, see, a lot of people have seen it. So after that, Bulgaria took the road of capitalistic country, but 45 years Bulgaria was under dictatorship. And you know what? We had a saying during this time when you were under the dictatorship. The saying was, they are pretending they're paying us, and we're pretending that we're working. Also, there was another saying. What is the difference between capitalism and communism?
Uh-huh. I don't know.
In capitalism, there is exploitation of men to men, and in the communism, it's just the opposite. So anyhow, what happened is that this capitalism became very wild and very savage and primitive, and also the mafia people took over. There's another saying in Bulgaria today, the other countries have a mafia, our mafia has a country. No, the mafia is the top places in the government everywhere. That's why I would rather, when I come back to my roots here to live, I married a great lady here, a great singer, you know, and I live in Greece because I would, in my age now, it will be a torture to live
mm-hmm.
there, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Hey, we have a lot of listeners who are student musicians. We also have a lot of music educators. Can you suggest some pieces for students and teachers who would be interested in understanding the Balkan jazz?
Well, I could say some names and titles to be not very many. I think that the first thing in order to first thing is the Papa, jazz, Louis Armstrong, Satchmo. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Even I would say, don't take something more too hard to understand, but take things that he did later. Hello, Dolly, for example.
Mm-hmm.
All of a sudden, he makes like Gil Evans at once. The true jazz artist could take some not that significant, not the stupid, I would say, but write songs, some made out of this song. Something music, new music, like later Coltrane took My Favorite Thing
sure.
for a musical, which is, I like the musical, but you know, musical is musical. Julie Andrews, blah, 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 you know. I'm sorry, I respect all kinds of music, but when Coltrane took this melody, it's not that melody, he made a symphony out of this,
mm-hmm.
you know. So, going back to Satchmo, then the next thing, to skip something, I'll go to Duke. Duke, anything. You play Take the A-Train, you play Sophisticated Lady, which is an incredible tune. The bridge of the tune is so incredible that Gershwin, George Gershwin, told Duke once, I wish I had written this bridge. So after Duke, I would say, the bebop,
mm-hmm.
the swing era, I could, for swinging, anything from bassy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The bassy band,
This is a machine for swing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Absolutely. So
yeah.
They have to understand that if ain't that swinging, it don't mean a thing. If ain't that swing, you know, I mean, Duke said it. All right, and then... some of the big bandera then go to the revolution, to bebop, Bert, Dizzy. Bert, of course, I would take, you know what, maybe because I'm classically trained, there is one album or two of Bert with strings.
Uh-huh.
Because people that are from Europe, they're more trained in classical music, in the strings, they'll bring them closer to what Bert plays, because if you play for some novice, the wild lines that Bert plays, he might get turned off.
Mm-hmm.
But when he plays the standards with the strings, in order to match the strings, he plays very tender, very,
mm-hmm.
you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
In that respect, I would definitely do more than jazz quartet.
Yes.
Because I think they're a fusion of jazz and classical music, you know? Right. They always have, like, not only using classical things by Bach or anything, but there's something classical, even the word classy, they have class.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I, personally, I, at the beginning, I understood some of these things better coming from the classical music, you know. For example, the Bert, when I heard him the first time, I realized there's something very powerful, but I couldn't follow him musically.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then I realized what a genius this man was, because he never played unnecessary notes, you
mm-hmm.
know. Never, 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 ever. And then we go up, I would say, the people that came, like the funky things, and like, for example, a guy like Bobby Timmons that wrote This Here, That There, you know, which is jazz, but it has more appeal to the people dancing, you know,
mm-hmm.
because there's nothing wrong to make you dance, you know. Even Basie, I think, said, well, it's very sad when the band plays and nobody dances.
Yeah, yeah.
So, and then the fusion, you know, we could choose all these people, like Weather Report, Don Ellis Band, Mahavishnu, John McLaughlin, you know. And be careful with guys like Cecil Taylor or Ned Coleman,
mm-hmm.
because that's the hardest to understand, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Of course, Coltrane in the side of the philosophical side, so to speak, you know, because Train was a very inside guy, you know. He wasn't a showman or, you know, like trying to show something. He was trying always to say something. Like a lot of jazz musicians of Cairn, I think. Another thing that they have to, when go on the stage, they have to show something or to prove something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even you're on the stage to say something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
That's a big difference, isn't it?
Yeah, very big difference.
Well, that's a great curriculum you've laid out for people of any age who want to appreciate the breadth of this amazing
uh-huh.
art. You know, it's an art form that has so many astonishing artists. It really takes a lifetime. To me, just to scratch the surface, and the beautiful thing, you can always discover somebody new. You can always discover new dimensions of an artist that you think you knew the artist, and then you listen a little more, and you realize there's a whole other world that you didn't perceive on your first few listens. So, Milcho, I want to thank you so much for giving us this time and the story of your life. Yeah, Now you're living in Thessaloniki.
Thessaloniki.
So if
is the second big town after Athens. The capital is in the north of Greece. It's a beautiful place. I live in the old town here, and it's 2 million people city. But I have a great yacht here and the music, and I don't travel anymore because I'm too old. But I write. Basically, I compose now, arrange. Because he cannot, you know, retire
from
uh-huh, uh-huh. Sure, you will do it till the end of your life, and that's it.
And then earlier you mentioned you have a website, is that correct?
Well, the website is my name without interruption, mutually with his older Sperry. Then put dot net, N-E-T, like T.
Gotcha.
Net, you know, yeah. So if you type this, it will come in Bulgaria, but you'll see the English flag. Flip it, and they'll tell you where you could get the information, because it has the call my picture, and then you go step by step, you'll find it. I think my bio, in terms of chronology of where I worked and what I wrote or something, is the best information there.
Great. Great.
And you know what? Since you say how hard it is to jazz, listen, it's hard, but jazz never stop, never will stop. You know the saying that they say jazz is coming back. And I say, like the other, no, jazz has only been here. Where were you?
Oh, that's great.
Look, I really enjoyed it, and your questions were very pertinent for the time we live now.